Thank you. Thank you for your contributions. Of course, the three of us, the, let's say, obedient academics, have tried to actually make sense of the term transcultural ready-made. Whereas, Kara, I don't think you have used the term, but can I still ask you whether you think it is a useful term? So think about maybe not only your own artistic practice, but also in a broader sense, as Margareta just fleshed it out.
Basically, I avoid to use the term transcultural and capitalism in my lecture. So the idea was to manage, to undulate between them. But I'm still working on it, because, and in a good sense, because it's very interesting also because I'm in French speaking and thinking, as soon as you talk about trans, it could be also transgenders. And very much, but also trans in the sense of being in trans. So being dispossessed from your own body or possessed by another spirit. So I think that this transculturality is, I don't know if it was you, Margaret, or you who talked about this, but I really like the dynamism that is actually the name of, in the sense that transculturality is this movement going back and forth between two states of mind, of things, and then so much, I mean, contemporary, so much in the problematic of now, so much glissant, so much in this idea of that the world is and culture is an archipelago. So, but I don't want to talk too much right now because I have a lot of, I think the last lecture really like echoes many things that I have been going through also the last years in terms of repatriations, etc. So I didn't use it, but if I may add is this dynamism which makes that the ready-made has also, I mean, carries also these unfinished things, neither started nor finished. And this is a speed, I mean, and probably something you cannot hold, you know? That's why it's interesting.
Maybe can I also ask the two of you and how far you think this is a term that is either something like too clumsy, maybe, also because the two terms, they're usually, I mean, until now, they have not been used together so much. Or is it something that for you also potentially in the future opens up a perspective on issues that you're working on anyway, which could be made productive? Because, I mean, as we discussed before, and as I also tried to point out at the beginning, I think it really doesn't matter whether it exists or not. It's more about whether it raises questions or if it enables us to address issues that we are interested in any way. And as we also saw, and as you also all kind of more or less explicitly spoke about, that is this act of framing and presenting and so on, it's funny because it seems so simple, but it's still something very complex because something happens which is very difficult to put in words. And that's why I think also artistic practices, as I try to briefly mention, are one of the few, like, and I think for very good reason, aesthetic modes in which this, let's say this, the complex of presenting can actually be addressed in a obviously different way than in a discursive way through language, but in a like at least equally complex way. I was wondering in how far, as we unfortunately mostly deal with language and how we analyze and also express our ideas, results of analysis, in how far that term is something that could be useful for you also in the future.
Well, I think it was when we were asked to think about the ready-made transcultural, I think it was used very useful to get started. But as you said, and as I think it all, it came very obvious in all the talks, it constantly defies the sort of the objecthood. Because we constantly talk about appropriation of shifting, of movement, of this trance, was it said, sort of it's moving back and forth. And so by because this term then constantly evades or escapes because it's not something you can pin down, but things happen in thinking through this through the ready-made. So I think as a concept of thinking through connections, thinking through constellations, through historical entanglements, I think it's useful, but you conclude with sort of terms or with descriptions or with comments that actually relativize it and actually point to the action, point to the happening, point to the movements. And so I think I like very much this idea of that it's a radical gesture that points towards particular needs of a respective society. So I think this gesture is crucial in thinking through it.
I think we when we met before, so it was really interesting to see what kind of questions were coming up when we were discussing the term. And yesterday at dinner, and also in Bernd Scherer's introduction, we talked of the idea of you talked about the magic of putting things on display and what it does, and in relation to ethnological objects. What is often said is basically when they're put on display, actually their magic disappears, it's killed, the object dies in the context of Western museums. So I thought this was an interesting reverse shift that basically for the ready-made, when you put it on display, or when you put any object on display now, there's still this magic of the display that works, and basically it transforms statues immediately. And it does the same with the ethnological object, but in a way that maybe takes the life out of it. And then I'd like to argue that actually you can reanimate it as well. And maybe this is what we are supposed to do now, that how can we reanimate them? What is return the only option, or what kind of role could those objects take today? What kind of appropriation is necessary to give them another form of life again? Mm-hmm. So to think about those displays and what it does as a gesture.
I think I think there's something very interesting in also what you've been commenting about the object as amputee, actually. Because I don't know, for those who have not seen the film I did on the phantom limb, the fact that if there's an amputation, there's always a ghost somewhere calling for repair. I've read an interesting article a year ago by John Pfeffer, who mentioned that in the end of the day, these objects kept in ethnographic museum in the West, old objects from Africa, are neither African now, nor Western. Neither African nor Western. They are floating in a cloud. They do not belong. We are not able to deal with them. This article really kept me like thinking about this at some point true. Because the question of repatriation is not that easy. We know that some part of the world, when objects from the past are discovered by radical groups, they are destroyed, for instance. But no, I think Daesh did not damage that much object than the market. That's another thing. But I have to say that recently, in a trip of researches I did in North America and Canada, basically with First Nations people, and you know that First Nations are the more active in terms of repatriation of their mask, of their fetishes, of their kisses, etc. I mean, of the object. I discovered interviewing chiefs and anthropologists from First Nation outside Toronto that even for them, the repatriation doesn't make sense sometimes, because they tell you that there was a woman, very interesting, who interrupted during the interview the chief, and she said, no, but these objects were used for healings. That's why we needed them. The problem is that today, traditional healers have no clue about how to use them. They have lost the language. They have lost the grammar, another consequences of colonization. They have lost the logos to use them. So this is to answer your question about the language, which I think is crucial here, definitely in terms of process of domination of the of groups onto others, and it raised these very complex questions of repatriation. I have to say that this was for me. I mean, I've been very much working and meeting anthropologists in France and in Belgium and in many places on this question of I did a work which is called Dispossession and investigating the collection of ethnographic objects old until now by Vatican. 90,000 objects held inside Vatican from Africa, from Latin America as well, but the best interesting masterpieces, iconic pieces of Congo, for instance, so are in Vatican, and they only exhibit like less than 50 objects. They are all kept in storages. So for me, it's a concern that really like makes sense, because, and I would like to finish on this, because in the end of the day, the whole question of what we are talking about is, what does it mean this now, today, the ready-made, to refer to a period of history that has happened a century ago. Why, what does it mean? It means that these objects that we go to visit to Imbolc Forum, to Quai Branly in Paris, to British Museum anywhere, have been brought through a colonial process, within a colonial time. I have to say that I was like astonished to discover these sepik accumulations of, I mean, which made me think about these also French exhibitions, like mm-hmm. Citroën exhibition, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. This is also interesting, mm-hmm. you know, this demon. And also the picture you showed with, I think I saw it once with the, I don't know who are they, if they are anthropologists or colonial administrator, you know, with the mask mm-hmm. of the, I don't know if it's the Bamoun Kingdom, yes. or it's Bamoun? Bamoun King, okay, with the mask of the Kom, which, I don't know if they're anthropologists or soldiers, but they are just like representing themselves sitting in front of war trophies. These are war trophies. They are not scientists, example of, you know, of let's say, of studies. They are war trophies. And also the way that Christian congregations through the world, everywhere, have been collected also, not only Vatican, no? In near Graz, I visited the White Sister, Sister Paola, I think, from the congregations, Mother House, where they have 2,000 objects from Africa. Near Ghent, in Mechelen, in Belgium, a Josephite congregation, where they have something like 9,000 objects collected in the whole 19th century, until now, because... So I think what I found interesting is to talk about these processes of what you said also, what I like very much, of the way that modernity has, slash colonialism, has been very much the agency of writing the history of the others. And from this to build a process, an intellectual process of withdrawing yourself, of repairing this this legacy in which we are living it, is not that easy.
Definitely. from your presentation, but also from what Annette and Marita were saying, I had the feeling that maybe what we could describe with the help of this slightly clumsy term of the transcultural readymade is maybe also something. I think someone called it a symptom, and maybe it's also just a layer of a process which is going on, or which has been going on anyway. And so in this way, I also find it interesting to think about how so-called theory and so-called practice are actually related to each other, which is anyway one of my favorite questions, but also in this context, because what we do is that we have this pretty elaborate discourse about the ready-made product, the transcultural ready-made, and so on and so forth. And we have certain practices that we look at, the artistic practices, but also the more in a more general sense, the practice and methods of display, presentation, institutional practices, and so on. And I think it is really interesting how those two spheres, which we still kind of try to separate so-called theory, so-called practice, overlap very quickly, swiftly, in a discussion, in a situation that we have right now. And I think also maybe in this context, this kind of terminology can be productive to understand how this actually works. Because, I mean, what you do could, if I like really reduce complexity, be almost considered as an aesthetic analysis of what happens in something called transcultural ready mating or something like that. But then there is you also contribute to the discourse, not only in this materialized art sense, but also in a discursive sense. And is that something that you, the two of you, could relate to, in how far that practice theory relation, which is I think also contained in a term like that, is that something that you can relate to or that is useful in any sense? Like, for instance, when you look at the institutional practices of ethnological museums in relation to the discourse that we are having?
I mean, I can say that for myself, I observe basically the making of new permanent exhibitions for the Humboldt Forum. And for me, this border between theory and practice, kind of as an anthropologist working within those institutions, really merge, because on the one hand, you try to analyze and see what is going on in those institutions, and then you try to, but at the same time, you contribute to the discourse while being in there. And I think this is exactly also what Kada's practice does, because it is received so much also within those museums that there are direct interlinks. There's no separation anymore, I would say, in that particular context of ethnological museums.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Okay, there's too much agreement here. Maybe you should open it up. Are there any questions from the audience?
The quote that Margareta von Oswald ended with, this issue of who recognizes whose authority to declare the authentic, to declare the copy, because clearly, in terms of thinking about the ready-made, we have this kind of interesting situation where we're giving a huge amount of authority to the artist's gesture and artist's declarative statement. But that also, that authority depends on sort of, in a sense, all of us being in on the game and a kind of consensus operating behind the scenes that recognizes that authority. So I guess I'm really, my sort of comment, question, observation is this idea of authority and agency over who actually is allowed to make a declaration about the status of the object.
Yeah, I would take it rather as a comment, but I think that that this is exactly what has to be altered in those museums. Who has the right to talk about those things, and who has the authority to basically detain that power? And this is what that was our first attempt to basically do it, to have another point of view, just a point of view, basically, that doesn't have consequences in that case, because even though it is clear and documented that the object has been stolen within this colonial robbery or looting, there are no claims from Cameroon to get it back, and there's no even option that this is going to happen. But I think this is exactly why I chose this quote, because it questions those statuses of authorship and of ownership and of writing of history, basically.
Yes, I wanted to link this very interesting question of the hybridization of original and copy, so to say, which you have presented, or in this wonderful quote you have been reading, to the more specialistic Duchamp discourses we had yesterday, which left a little bit some of the people here maybe as a kind of very specific discussion among the Duchamp guys. And but what Lars presented yesterday, the question of the multiple and the ready-made, is in fact very similar to this question, because there are no originals and there are copies made which represent the originals now. Any ready-made you will see in any museum never is an original by Duchamp, you know. And then when it comes to the power who has to decide which object has which status, similar conflicts, in a way, similar but different, may arise, because of these multiples there have been made more copies than are on the market now, and now they suddenly appear as a kind of supplementary objects, you know. So are these then legal Duchampian objects or not? And then there is a debate with the estate. So you see, power relation even enters this field where Duchamp tried to escape any kind of power through the process of commodification, musealization, and all these things enter the same field of the Duchampian ready-made, which is in a kind also in a limbo, in a kind of nowhere situation. You can't give it back to anybody, and you can't take it out of the museum anymore. No, none of these gestures makes sense, you know. And just to link the two discourses of yesterday and today a little.
Can I say something about the copy? Because we were talking about Cameroon, and I don't know if you know, but at almost 300 kilometers from Douala in Cameroon, there are a couple of villages where they produce. They produce most of the copies you see everywhere in the world. Any you go to the flea market here, if you see someone selling African Marx copy, like the one which was in your slideshow, I think there was a very beautiful long fang mask. You know this long beige mask?
Oh, that was I think
was in the slideshow.
The MoMA, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This mask actually is a copy of one mask we did like 6 million euro in the Collection Vérité auction sales 10 years ago. It was this iconic fang, and I was very surprised to see a copy here. What I want to say is that I have an interesting anecdote. One day I was with my friend artist Jean-Jacques Lebel, who is also the son of Lebel, who did the first biography of Marcel Duchamp, and collector. And Jean-Jacques, our home is like a cabinet of curiosity. There was our friend, Algerian Berber French, the son of the poet Jean Amrouche, Pierre Amrouche, who is one of the biggest experts of African art in the world. He specialized in Gabon. And when he was about to leave the dinner, we were about to leave, he saw a kissy on the floor, which was representing illness faces, you know, with the mouth here and the nose. As far as I'm concerned, I've never seen kissy representing illness. There was mask. But I never dare to say, Jean-Jacques, this is a weird object. Anyway, Pierre Amrouche says, cet objet n'existe pas. And Jean-Jacques said, why? For you? No, it doesn't exist. And Jean-Jacques said, maybe now, but it will exist in 500 years. And then he started to develop, as an artist, how much he considered that you as an ethnologist, and especially someone who is supposed to be, who is an expert, who deliberate expertise of collections and objects, that the fact that an object, this was so beautiful, the fact that in the end of the day, these ethnological objects are expansion of our bodies. They are the continuation of our bodies. When you go to visit an exhibition of object, you look at mask, you look at kissy, there is a physical continuation, even spiritual one and intellectual one. These objects are expansions of the body, to go back to this notion of amputee also, which is interesting, because communities who have been dispossessed from their object, they feel this amputation. And as an artist who's also collecting things, not as a collector. Basically, Jean-Jacques, like he has been also educated by André Breton, was and still is crazy about flea market. All his objects and collection have been found in a puce of the north of Paris, Clignancourt, most of them. And I found this, cet objet n'existe pas from an expert, and the answer of an artist, very interesting, again, in the sense that there's no rule, actually. There's no rule. There is this sort of, I think, certainty that as soon as you look at an object, it becomes an expansion of your body, of your social body, if you prefer, or you get part of this social body, of this corpus that is the, that from which this social, this the this object belongs to. So, why this body expansion is for me very important? Because most of the time, when an expertise on a mask is made, especially in dealers, is if the mask has danced or not. If the mask has not danced, it has no, let's say, interest in the tribal market. But of course, this doesn't make sense because there are masks which have been like sometimes dancing one time or not at all, but became fetish as well, have been celebrated as fetish. So this is what I wanted to add about. And then just to finish with these copy issues, I asked the question once in Senegal to guys who were sculpting masks, telling them you are doing copies for tourists. And they said, oh, but you guys from the West, you think that copy is the reproduction of something by which is similar. But us here, because we are not machine, we do not standardize the reproduction of the fake mask. So if you look at 20 masks made by a copyist of the same kind of, they do not look the same. Some of them can be very interesting, like Jacques Hénard told me in Neuchâtel Museum, when this group of museum had to cut a mask, a Punu mask with an axe for an exhibition called the L'Objet Trouvé, and they agreed to go all together in this copy place in Africa, 10 ethnologists, anthropologists, to choose a copy, a thing that has not been danced, which has not been charged, let's say, with energy, just to illustrate their purpose. So this is it. This is what basically I wanted to say. Thank you.
I have one comment and one question. First of all, because we're speaking about this in the context of Marcel Duchamp, I just wanted to make a point, as we've been discussing non-Western art practices for some time on this panel. And it's astounding to see that when you visit the Koçi Muziris Biennial, when you look at contemporary Turkish artists, for many of them, contemporary art practice I'm talking about also in Africa, Marcel Duchamp is somewhat of a patron saint because he is conceived as having gone up against the Western canon. And that is something that many artists feel very much, in line with. So I thought that was an interesting thing when it comes to contemporary artistic practices, some of the countries that you've talked about. The other thing is this, you speak about the transcultural. This month's issue of Frieze magazine is an entire issue devoted to the question of appropriation, a term that you have also used on the panel. And it's about cultural appropriation, and it's about who's allowed to speak. And if we look at Dana Schütz, for example, at the Whitney Biennial, if we look at the discussion about Sam Durand, for example, if you look at the social media shitstorm that when all hell broke loose when PETA was against two works that are being shown currently are not shown anymore at the Guggenheim Museum. What I'm saying is that the flip side of all of that is also a call for censorship for many of your institutions of how to deal with these things. And I was wondering, especially with Margarete von Oswald, when you're showing a slide of a 1935 MoMA exhibition and you put an asterisk where a name should go, why are you, Susan Sontag said the worst form of censorship is self-censorship. Why don't you stay true to the history for good or for worse? Why do you choose to put an asterisk where we all know a certain word should go? That is what I would like to know. Thank you.
I had a discussion about this with my colleagues, and actually I didn't want to spell out the word, because we do know what it means, but we don't have to repeat it because it does harm to other people. So I don't think that that this consists in censorship, but it kind of consists in a certain empathy, maybe.
And there was one final, two final questions.
Hey, thank you for allowing me to ask the final question. I want to go back a little bit to the beginning of the session, if that's okay. I was wondering how we can come to grips with a dimension of the ready-made you, Benjamin, addressed in your introduction, the dimension of these temporary shifts. And I mean, so this question basically regards a dialectics of musealization versus temporary shifts of status. And I mean, it was mentioned that the ready-made initially was like it was a provocation, or it challenged a certain notion of the art object. And I think Duchamp's ready-made fulfills this promise to a certain degree. We know that the pissoir is not an original, and that was already mentioned. And but we also know that Duchamp very consciously worked towards the musealization of his objects, of his works. For example, with the Boîte en Valise, or with Étant donné, his last work, he really schemed and planned the musealization of his works in the Philadelphia Art Museum very consciously. And of course, his objects also have signatures, but that's only just another dimension of this. So I was wondering, I think these shifting objects, which don't end up in a museum like Duchamp's ready-mades, they put our Western fetishization of objects, which is happening in museums, also to ethnographic objects. You could also say fetishization as an act of displacement, amputation. So these shifting objects put that much more under pressure, maybe. So maybe these shifting objects suggest a solution also to the problem of the transcultural fetish, ready-made. And I was also then thinking that maybe Clémentine Delis' solution of implementing an artist in residence program in Frankfurt, I guess temporarily while she was there at Weltkulturmuseum, maybe that was also, you know, a temporary shift. These artists interacted with the objects of the collection, temporarily shifted their contexts. So I can't yet really come to grips with that, and I was just wondering if it's something interesting to discuss a bit further.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were many interesting aspects in what you just said, which have to be discussed further. To keep it very brief, I think that the term ready-made and the acts and processes through which something can be turned into ready-made, I think that we are just having the discussion now, 100 years later, is maybe part of the reason is what you also basically said, that that those shifts from one almost ontological category into the other is something that we are obviously still grappling with in many different spheres, not only in the museum, because we cannot can obviously not come up with a solution, I think, with a satisfying answer to the question how these things work. And also we are dealing with very ephemeral phenomena. Also the status itself is extremely ephemeral. So I think there's a reason why we will probably not come to an end with this discussion. But yeah, Bert.
First of all, I think what one has to see when the ethnological objects were taken out of its original context, this move was a counter move to what Duchamp did. because it was a de-animation of these objects. Because these objects, they have a living context to them. They were alive in their original cultures. So taking them out, there was a de-animation process. Now they are here, and I think Kara made it very clear, they have no, at the moment, no life in their original cultures. There is no context, there is no logos, no way of living with these objects. They are here, of us. So I think what is left out most of the time of the debate is we have to reanimate these objects in our context. We do not know what they mean for us. And of course for us as colonial powers, as people who exported violence to other countries. So I think instead of constantly reflecting only how one can involve the others in this process is very much a process of on our cultures. It's a question how to deal with it. And to take the Humboldt Forum as a reference point, as Margarita did in her presentation, I think the big issue is the problems with this problem is this building is a representation of Germany because it's a representation project of the parliament, of the government, and so on. And now, let's say the bad spirit, the not capacity of animating these objects in our context is working back on the whole project. So the project, the problems we are facing with this project is that we looked on these objects just on objects from other worlds. They are part of our world. And I think this part of the reflection is not really done yet.
Yeah, and I think to add to this, I think this notion of the temporary shift, I think is a very crucial strategy to induce it to come to terms with what it means. So if you constantly, because then you break out of those definite stories that it was mentioned in your quote, I think, to constantly change the constellations of how an object can be seen and thereby to reveal those things that matter to us.
And of course, talking to the people from other cultures and negotiating with them is part of this process of reanimating that in our, but it's not the only solution. I mean, it's not, we should not start to project again our problems in the others.
But I think what we're witnessing with the Humboldt Forum is exactly what you're describing. So basically, James Clifford once described the museum as a contact zone, but and now what other, like Nora Sternfeld and Dan Hicks have proposed, it has turned into a conflict or a shock zone. So basically, this is these are the places where those difficult histories are now being negotiated. And this is what I try to highlight with this idea of the objects as agents. So basically, the masses that have been amassed in Europe, they're so big that we can't resist them anymore, basically. They are revolting against their statues.
Thank you very much, the three of you and also the audience for staying with us. And we'll have a 15-minute break now. Yes? Okay. Thank you.